I mean, I think whilst Trump is doing is becoming more popular within the United States with this narrative that it's a waste of money supporting Ukraine, I don't think that ending support necessarily is going to end the conflict overnight.
The funny thing that someone has discovered at the Center of Strategic Studies is if you read Project 2025, which is Trump's like shadow policy doctrine, they have copied and pasted entire elements of Biden's approach to Africa.
Both Harris and Trump, either of them need to address the topic of asylum.
Welcome to Civics and Cynics, your politics podcast for the digital age. I'm Les Paz, Professor of Digital Technology, Governance and Policy at the Hasso Plattner Institute of the University of Potsdam. We're releasing this episode on Election Day in the US. Although as many as half of ballots may already have been cast, opinion polls place this election on a knife edge, with different outcomes resting on tiny vote margins in a few key swing states. Naturally, there has and will continue to be in this a huge amount of focus on US domestic politics. But Path to Power is a global research project, so in this episode we've gathered all four members of our research team to talk about the global implications of a Harris versus a Trump presidency. Our team, Ewan, Jamie, Juan, and Omar, outline what different election outcomes could look like in Eastern Europe, Central Asia, Sub-Saharan Africa, Latin America, South Asia, and the Middle East. They discuss how in some cases, different victories could change the outcomes of wars or the progress of human rights abuses. But in other cases, the policies seem so similar that one side, guess which one, may have just copied their homework from the other. And on that subject, we know civics takes work. So generally, we ask you to stick around to the end of an episode to hear what homework we'd suggest if the topics and issues discussed within move you. But we also know that civics relies on healthy, happy, and diversely rich citizenries. So this week, stick around to the end to hear the team's film and literary recommendations if you need a new cultural diversion from what may be days or even months of uncertainty and contestation over the results of the US election, particularly in the case of an announced Harris victory. Our research and outreach activities are hosted in the Hasso Plattner Institute of the University of Potsdam and funded by the German Development Corporation. However, the ideas and opinions presented herein are entirely those of the speakers.
Hello and welcome to Civics and Cynics, the podcast of the HPI's Digital Governance, Technology and Policy Research Group. I'm your host, Dr. Jamie Ranger, and in this special episode, we're going to be focusing on the effects of the upcoming US election on diverse countries and peoples from all around the world, living in Latin America to South Asia, the Middle East to Africa. We have all hands on deck today, and we've assembled the Avengers. Oh, well, that's a terrible choice of labels. We've assembled a team here at the HPI's Governance, Technology and Policy Research Group today to discuss the relevant topics. But before we dive in, it's important to remember that elections, particularly those in major global players like the United States, have far-reaching consequences. Policies and decisions made in Washington, D.C. can ripple across continents, influencing economic trends, international relations, technology standards, and to put it mildly, even local governance. Today, we'll explore those ripples. What a change in leadership might mean for global political alliances, trade agreements, and the diverse experiences of people in different regions of the world. Our goal is to move beyond the headlines and into the nuanced impacts these elections can have on everyday lives far beyond the American borders. All right, other members of the team, let's introduce ourselves and what regions we'll be focusing on today.
Hi, my name is Ewan Thomas Cahoon. I'm a doctoral researcher here at the HPI, and I'm going to be talking about Eastern Europe and Central Asia.
Hi, this is Juan Gomez Cruces. Postdoctoral researcher here at the HPI, and I'm talking about Latin America.
Hi, my name is Omar Jan. I'm a postdoctoral researcher here at the HPI, and I'll be focusing on South Asia and the Middle East. Ewan, let me start with you. Could you give us an overview of why the US elections should or do matter in a region like Central Asia and Eastern Europe?
Yeah, thank you very much for the question. I should start by saying I'm not a conflict and security expert, but I'm going to be talking a lot about conflict today. So I think important to take the things I say with a pinch of salt. But I do know about the politics of the region. So let's dive straight in. Looking first at Eastern Europe, I think the most important topic, and this won't come as a surprise to anyone, is the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. And I think here the US elections really represent a fork in the road. If we consider that Harris's policies could likely be a continuation of Biden's, then we'll likely see trends continue in that direction, whereas a Trump election could have serious implications for the entire region. short of putting a full sales sign in the entirety of Eastern Europe, I think it could very much weaken the alliances which define the region. So if we start with the scenario in which Harris wins the election, we'll continue to see America being a large donor of equipment and financial aid to Ukraine. And I think in this scenario, the most important factor will actually be the Senate and House elections, which take place on the same day. We've seen that the majority of Republican lawmakers are now against providing continued lethal aid to Ukraine. But what I think is probably the most likely scenario in this situation is that we're going to see a return of the kind of quid pro quo that we saw over the winter of last year, where issues like the southern border of the United States, support for Israel, will be traded within Congress and within the Senate against providing Ukraine with extra support. How this works within Ukraine, within the conflict, is very difficult. I think there's no indication at the moment that the US will provide the kind of lethal aid which would allow the Ukraine, would allow Ukraine to progress to the borders of 2014. So I think we'll likely see a continued war of attrition. And if the House and Senate do block the supplies of weapons, ammunition to Ukraine for a significant period, I think it will be significantly weakened in its ability to respond to Russian aggression. If we then take a look at the Trump side, I think Trump and particularly J.D. Vance, his running mate, have been quite vocal opponents of Ukrainian support. With Trump saying, for example, Ukraine is gone, it doesn't exist anymore, that he claims that Ukraine is completely demolished. I think this will cause particular concern within Ukraine. As we saw last year with the fall of Avdiivka, the Ukrainians are reliant on these munitions support from Russia, from America. I think whilst Trump is doing, is becoming more popular within the United States with this narrative that it's a waste of money supporting Ukraine, I don't think that ending support necessarily is going to end the conflict overnight. Because neither the Ukrainians nor the Russians have really seen success within their war goals. I think despite what a lot of the Republicans would claim, the Russians are still interested in taking Kyiv, have not changed their war goals from the demilitarization of the country, which a lot of people understand as the destruction of the current political system, regime change. And the Ukrainians on the other side, we saw President Zelensky's victory plan presented to the parliament recently. What Ukraine is really looking for is a credible security commitment within the region. And this security commitment looks to the Ukrainians like NATO membership. And under Trump, it seems very unlikely that there'll be further support for the enlargement of NATO. Other options that have been suggested is also bringing in NATO troops as a tripwire force on the border, which means that if there is some kind of ceasefire deal achieved, you have these forces there to prevent the Russians firing into Ukraine because there is the concern about hitting NATO troops. I think this agreement doesn't also look like it's anywhere in the pipeline. And the third option that the Ukrainians have talked about and that Zelensky raised with Trump was the possibility of Ukrainian nuclear armament, which I think raises significant concerns globally around nuclear proliferation, but is as a response to the sort of Russian saber-rattling around nuclear weapons, seems like a pretty straightforward way to get these security commitments within Ukraine. So I'm going to move now to talk about the Caucasus, Central Asia, where I think it could be quite easy to overstate the US influence. US influence is really waning in the region, particularly after the withdrawal from Afghanistan. The US has closed its military bases in Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan. And whilst there is some intelligence support and some financial support for operations against ISK in the region, I don't see Central Asia or the Caucasus becoming a significant area of American concern in the coming years. At the same time, I don't think that the US aid to the region is going to change particularly much, as this has been kind of focused on democracy promotion, energy and trade, these kind of areas. And I think this is something that is such a drop in the ocean of the American foreign budget that it just won't be on the priorities for the Americans to change.
Thank you, Ivan, for this insightful analysis. Let me bring in Juan, let's talk about Latin America, Juan. How do you expect this to play out in the event of both the Trump and Harris presidencies?
Thank you, Omar. Well, as you mentioned, U.S. presidencies have a huge impact on Latin America. Historically, we share 3,000 kilometers of border. There's a lot of issues individually, as many for many countries, but also as a region. So today I'm gonna raise three topics that I believe are representative of how either a Harris presidency or a Trump presidency might have different outcomes, but in some cases the outcome might be pretty much the same. So the first one is immigration. This campaign has addressed this issue a lot, but we don't really, well, on the side of Trump, there is a lot of talk about immigration because it's a hot topic, and he has he can raise a lot of emotions based on immigration. On the side of Harris, there's no much clarity on what she would do different to Trump. She has been kind of avoiding the topic because the Biden administration somehow allowed this immigration crisis that from which Trump is taking advantage electorally. So the thing is, in the case of Trump, we might seen he has promised massive deportations. This can be a promise, a political promise, an electoral promise. It's not clear to what extent he will be able to fulfill this promise, but it's clear that he's going to try it. And if this happens, even if it's not as massive as he has promised, it might end up in this destabilization of countries in Central America, especially Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, and that would have a destabilization effect, especially in three aspects. We might expect gang violence rising, economic issues, more unemployment, and even in countries like El Salvador, massive incarcerations, as the president in El Salvador is following this policy of incarcerating almost everyone. But regardless of this promise of Trump, both Harris and Trump, either of them need to address the topic of asylum. It's very probable that that the kind of asylum that the system of asylum as is right now, it's going to change in both cases. Even democratic liberal cities like Denver that are receiving many refugees, they are saying that they cannot keep receiving that amounts of people. So in both cases, we would expect that the criteria to get an asylum would be the bar is going to be higher now, and this as well is going to create some pressures within Latin America in countries like Venezuela, where a lot of people are fleeing from the current regime. So we might see some changes on that, regardless of who wins. But in the case of a Trump presidency, we might expect more pressure, more destabilization in Central America, especially. The other topic is more concerning Mexico. It's about trade. In 2020, Trump renegotiated the NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. And There were some concessions from the three parts. And now in 2026, there's going to be a review of the new agreement, the USMCA. With Harris, we might expect a more focus on environmental sustainability within the agreement. Also to protect more labor rights, even though labor rights are is very subject. Which country has weaker labor rights? In the case of Trump, we might expect he has mentioned that his favorite word is tariffs. So we might expect him to push higher tariffs to Mexican imports. There's also this concern that maybe China is using Mexico as a backdoor to enter the U.S. market, taking advantage of this free trade agreement. So we would expect harsher negotiation with Trump than it would be with Harris. The things that might be relevant for Harris, some things that Mexican government can concede not easily, but for instance, in the case of environmental sustainability, the current Mexican president it's been very adamant about moving forward with green energy, more sustainable approach to development. So that's the second topic. And the third one, it has to do with political alignment in the region. If in the case of a Trump presidency, we might expect a very tense relation between Trump on one side, Bukele, the Salvadoran president, and Milei in Argentina as a one right-wing populist group of leaders against a more left-wing bloc with Claudia Sheinbaum in Mexico, with Lula in Brazil, Boric in Chile, Petro in Colombia. So for the first time, Brazil and Mexico would be in the same bloc and might be a confrontation with Washington, with a less unbalanced relationship of power. Of course, the U.S. Has a lot of power, but this could create tensions. But for the first time, this bloc opposing some of the desires of the U.S. Can be somehow counteract. On the other side, if Harris is the president, it would be very interesting that we would expect more collaboration probably with Mexico, with Brazil, with Chile, with Colombia, and to some extent also governments like the one in El Salvador or in Argentina might face pressure to change some of their policies. They're especially in El Salvador, where massive incarcerations are in place. So maybe an eventual Harris presidency will be the beginning for a front to or against Bukele's policies that are often violating human rights. So pretty much, those are three of the issues that might be more contrasting between these two candidates. So we will see what happens.
Thank you, Juan. That was expansively brilliant. Let me bring in Jamie here. Jamie, let's turn to different nations in Africa. You give us a broad overview of how Washington's foreign policy plays out vis-a-vis these nations.
Yeah, so Africa's a big place. There's 56 countries, you know, a lot of diversity amongst individual nation states. So you're going to be getting a very broad approach to Africa, but America itself also has several approaches to Africa that are quite broad and encompass a lot of countries. So we should be all right. So I think the best place to start would be the African Growth and Opportunity Act, which was a program launched by Bill Clinton in 2000. And this provides eligible countries from Africa with tariff-free access to US markets. And that continues to be an influential program. So it's stuff like access to raw materials, textiles, clothing. And this trade agreement was extended until 2025. And it basically grants tariff relief for imports for more than 30 countries in sub-Saharan Africa. And according to the UN Comtrade database, the US is the second most important exporter for goods from South Africa in 2022 after China with just 9%. Sorry. So for a security perspective, the US is really important for many countries in the fight against insurgencies, particularly in West and East Africa. Obviously, we can't really talk about Africa without talk about China and Russia. So the US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, visited South Africa. He visited the DRC and he visited Rwanda in August as part of a trip that was aimed at weakening Africa's relations with both China and Russia. And on that trip, Linda Thomas-Greenfield visited Uganda and Ghana and said that African nations cannot do trade with Russia or they'll be violating Western sanctions. So the big question for any administration, whether it's a Harris administration or a Trump administration, is, will you renew the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act? So the act's inherent strength stems from the fact that it's a direct answer to African leaders demanding a relationship with Washington that's based on trade and not aid. But it's often used in quid pro quo context, as what I've just described. So at the moment, only 32 of the 54 countries currently qualify for duty-free access to the US market, and 80% of the benefits only affect five countries. So as much as they can do quid pro quo, a lot of countries are now so divorced from this act having any real meaningful effect on their economy that they're free to kind of look at, assess their options on the geopolitical space. The other aspect of this is long-term, since the 2000s, and especially around the time of Obama taking office, long-term disapproval of US foreign policy in Africa, right? One would say that not since Obama was elected president have Africans generally believed that the White House would materially affect their well-being. And that ended very quickly when the Libyan leader, Muammar al-Gaddafi, was overthrown in 2011, who at the time was one of the most popular leaders in Africa on the continent. So since then, there's been a case of looking at any American administration as a hypocrite, which obviously then opens the door to maybe trying to get a better deal or getting into competing for, if we've got resources, who wants to sell them, rather than getting involved in like geopolitical squabbles between the likes of the US and Russia and China. The other aspect of this is the Biden administration, when they started their kind of project towards Africa, they pushed for the idea that Africa will have a seat on the UN Security Council. Biden made a promise in a speech about doing this, and it's been 2 years and there still isn't a UN Security Council seat for Africa. Africa now, collectively, African Union is now pushing for two permanent seats. So that's been like an aspect of the kind of international promises haven't been delivered. But also, neither Trump or Kamala Harris have acknowledged Africa during the campaign at all and haven't mentioned this. So we don't really know what the position is going to be for either of these candidates. What we can say, though, is the Harris administration is probably going to stay faithful to Biden's US strategy toward sub-Saharan Africa, which was a thing in 2022, which implies they're going to extend this earlier trade agreement. It's probably going to come with more quid pro quo. So presumably, unless there's a peace treaty on the table in Ukraine tomorrow, presumably there'll still be a improve human rights and you get more stuff angle to it. Harris herself visited Ghana, Tanzania and Zambia in 2023 to talk up this deal. But she's also fallen into the trap of talking about the kind of debt trap diplomacy of China, which works when you're in Ghana and it works when you're in Zambia, who are both countries that have actively pivoted away from China. But in most countries in Africa, you're trying to be as neutral as possible on that issue. And empirically, there's been a lot of research that shows the debt trap diplomacy is kind of a myth. Right? There's a lot of large-scale debt forgiveness programs that were announced in 2023 by China. And the only places where they didn't forgive debt were places where they let Harris talk about how bad debt is in China. So there seems to be, again, the quid pro quo is coming in as well on the Chinese angle. The funny thing that someone has discovered at the Center of Strategic Studies is if you read Project 2025, which is Trump's like shadow policy doctrine, they have copied and pasted entire elements of Biden's approach to Africa, which implies that he hasn't thought about it at all, or they're just going to keep everything the same. But also, there is this perception on the continent that because Trump's an isolationist nationalist, that he'll leave Africa alone. But there was no real significant shift in US foreign policy between the kind of Trump administration, the Biden administration.
Thank you, Jamie, for that insightful analysis. Now let's move on to South Asia and West Asia. Umar, can you tell us about the implications of the U.S. election in this region?
Thank you, Juan. I'm going to focus first on India, because in the recent decades, India has emerged as like a major strategic partner of the U.S. in the region. It's the security and defense coordination between India and the U.S. Is not an alliance per se, but let's say it's a deep partnership that converges around, of course, the growing influence of China in the region. There are various other areas of partnership, for example, trade and technological exchange. But the strategic partnership is mostly focused on countering China, and this fits into what's called US's Indo-Pacific strategy. I'm gonna first talk about the potential Harris presidency, and then go into the potential Trump presidency. We have seen during the Biden administration that the partnership with India continued at the same pace almost, and there were no major shifts, even when there were major points of conflict. This will broadly continue within the Harris administration. We might see a bit more focus on like what is called the value-based diplomacy. A bit more focus on India's domestic issues, for example, human rights issues. Even this won't be a major point of divergence, because we have all seen, like, in the sense of realpolitik, human rights tend to always take a backseat. Continuation of Biden's policies with Harris administration. On the other hand, if Donald Trump is reelected, the dynamic could be a bit different. But not vis-a-vis China. There will be again like massive convergence when it comes to US's Indo-Pacific strategy on countering China. But there's also like a potential for unpredictability when it comes to Trump administration. So India might be worried about that in terms of focus on tariffs. So the trade partnership might see a bit of a realignment. But one other major point is about immigration issues. Trump might cut down on what is known as the H-1B visa when it comes to immigration, and this has a potential to kind of play not a substantially disruptive role, but like at least this might be a point of contention in an eventual Trump presidency. Moving on to Pakistan, again during Biden administration, Pakistan was seen as it, from the prism of security partnerships by Washington, especially after U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. There doesn't seem to be an incentive for Washington to really like engage deeply with Pakistan, but still, there seems to be like a convergence on issues like Islamic State's growing like strength in Afghanistan, which is called the Islamic State Khorasan province. So basically, there's going to be continuation on partnerships on counterinsurgency, this will continue on to Harris administration, especially because there has been a change of guard in Islamabad. The government has changed, and the previous government seemed, at least at the end, a bit more hostile towards Washington. So the head of the government, the previous government, Imran Khan, accused Washington of orchestrating basically a coup against him, his government. And during that period, the tensions naturally grew. But since the change of government in Pakistan, this has the relationship has been much more steady on counterinsurgency and also on economic fronts. Turning to Trump, the first presidency, Washington was mostly focused on how Pakistan allegedly became a safe haven for insurgents, and therefore Trump proceeded on to cut around $1.3 billion in military aid to Pakistan. And the U.S. also suspended long-standing military training programs for Pakistani officers. I have a feeling that that the second Trump presidency might see even a more disengaged approach, especially because the U.S. no longer has troops in Afghanistan. Moving on further west to West Asia, or what's also called the Middle East, and specifically on the Palestine-Israel conflict, we all know that U.S. is a key strategic ally of Israel. There's no secret there. The extent of partnership, military, economic, and diplomatic, is no secret. So according to a recent report by the Watson Institute at Brown University, during the past 1 year of war in Gaza, the U.S. has spent at least $22.7 billion on military aid to Israel and related operations in the Middle East. And this, according to Watson Institute, is a conservative estimate. So while Biden administration has ironically emphasized on the need for a ceasefire, to keep this war running, Israel is of course dependent on Washington D.C. on so many different levels. So in this scenario, whether it comes to Harris presidency or to Trump presidency, we might not see any shift at all. But where we might see a bit of divergence is on Iran. Trump might be a bit more blustery when it comes to rhetoric. So, for example, during the recent escalation of tensions with Iran in the region, the messaging largely from Biden administration was that of restraint. But this is going to continue with Harris. But with Trump presidency, we might see a bit more like forceful messaging when it comes to Iran. On the Persian Gulf states, which are key allies of the U.S., such as, for example, UAE, Qatar, Bahrain. Interestingly, during the past three presidential cycles, the messaging from Washington has been that they would like to pivot from their focus on the Middle East and focus more on the Indo-Pacific region and their competition with China. This was true for Obama, for instance. This was true for Trump and also for Biden. But during the past year, that we have like clearly seen that this cannot be the case, and they cannot afford to do that. So we will not see a major change of U.S. foreign policy when it comes to Persian Gulf states.
Yeah, Uma, thank you. That was really interesting to listen to. So as the first time speaker today, or speaking for the first time today, I've been given the wonderful task of introducing the homework for this week. So I'd like to hear from each of you what you think our listeners should be doing with their free time. If I go ahead and start, I think for those who want to escape the noise around the American election and see something a little bit more interesting, perhaps, or at least a bit of an escape, I would recommend the film The Needle. It's directed by Rashid Nurmagomedov. It's in the Kazakh New Wave cinema field. I think it's something that you probably wouldn't have seen before, and it's a great film. Features Viktor Tsoi, one of the greatest, or probably the greatest rock star from the Soviet Union. Very worth a watch, and very different to the US election.
Okay, my homework is going to be Wizard of the Crow. The Wizard of the Crow is written in 2006 by Ngugi Wa Thiong'o, who is, he's 86, he's still with us. He's known as the leading East African writer, but I would argue that there's a case to be made that he's one of the leading writers, full stop. The book itself is a satire about rule in a fictional African country. There is a ruler known only as the ruler, and there is a kind of Kafkaesque, kind of Thomas Pynchon-esque kind of interrogation of what it means to try and get through everyday life under colonial rule and kind of arbitrary nature of like bureaucracy. And it's very much recommended. Juan, what's your research or song or film or anything you want to ask the readers about?
Well, the book I'm recommending, Funny Story, this was also recommended by Hugo Chavez to Barack Obama in some summit. It's the open veins of Latin America. You have to, it's by Eduardo Galeano. It has a bias, obviously, an ideological bias, so you have to take it with your reserves. But it's a good source to understand how U.S. interventions during the 20th century now has some repercussions on the issues that the region faces. So I think it's interesting. So tell us, Umar, what's your homework?
My recommendation is a book called Sinews of War and Trade, Shipping and Capitalism in the Arabian Peninsula. It's written by this brilliant academic based in the UK, if I'm not wrong, called Laleh Khalili. So this book basically is like an ethnographic historical account of how maritime transportation is central to the fabric of global capitalism.
All right, and that's your podcast. That's your homework. Thanks so much for listening. At the time of recording, we have no idea who won the US election, so let's hope the lights are still on in a week. And if you've got anything you want to send us, recommend us, comments, criticism, constructive or otherwise, can be sent to our email. Thanks so much for listening, and until next time, bye.